The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. If you'd like to contact us here on the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We can find us on Twitter, we're at News Talk Science. Coming up on this week's programme, the science and art of negotiation with David Salley, something I am notoriously rubbish at. Let's hope there are some good stories in the news as we look back at the week's science. And joining me via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lauren Dungan. You're both very welcome, guys. There are one or two COVID stories out there, and we've kind of covered COVID, at least the science of it, quite a bit over the past number of months. There is one story, Lara, about, before we get into our first real story, there is one story about people over 6 foot having a bigger chance of getting COVID, but I think, as Shane Bergen quipped before we started the show, that it just doesn't stand up.
Oh, Shane, the physicist with the comedy behind him. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's basically, they did a survey of 1,000 people in the UK and people over in the US, and it said people over 6 foot were getting COVID more frequently. I mean, it's, you know, just that. It's a survey. It's a correlation. No evidence that their height is the cause of it, so I wouldn't be getting worried if you're over 6 foot just at this stage.
So if you're John Cleese or something, you don't need to panic.
No panicking necessary.
All right, our first story. Shane, has to do with a quantum thermometer, whatever the hell that is.
Yeah, so this is work from colleagues in Trinity Physics and UCD Physics coming together at last to work on a proposed or theoretical quantum thermometer. And this is, in theory, going to be used to measure gases that are incredibly cold. So listeners may have heard this week about very high temperatures in the likes of Death Valley, with temperatures there going above 54 Celsius. However, if you go in the other direction, you can go lower and lower in temperature until you reach a minimum. So there is an absolute zero in temperature. And so when we think of temperature, in school I was taught that temperature is the measure of how hot something is, which is a ridiculous way to define it. Physicists would think about the movement of all of the constituent atoms or molecules of a substance. And you take a statistical average of their movement, and that gives you a sense of temperature. So if it's hot, they're moving faster. If it's colder, they're moving slower. And this idea of particles moving worked perfectly fine until the 20th century, when we evolved from that classical view of physics to with discrete points of matter, so that atoms were kind of little lumps. And then we moved into the 20th century, where we realized that they had more wave-like behavior, so the quantum world of physics, where particles on that tiny, tiny scale actually have a more fluid-like behavior. And so they postulated that below a certain temperature, the individual wave nature of atoms would kind of coalesce with their neighbors, such that you get this quantum behavior at a scale that you can see with your eyes. In other words, the quantum behavior that's normally only associated with tiny atoms would now be seen at very low temperatures for big macroscopic real world things like a gas. So the plan is to use a special thermometer to measure how cold this gas is. And it's very difficult to measure temperature at this scale. And typically they've just done it through inferral. So they've not directly measured it. And the guys in Trinity and UCD have postulated a thermometer that would use an atom that would probe the cold gas that they're cooling down, and it would create what's called a quantum superposition. So you'd mix in one atom into a very cold gas of another, and you get this quantum superposition where it is both interacting with and not interacting with each other at the same time. And that superposition is known to be very sensitive to temperature. So you can tell with huge accuracy, they predict, the temperature of this cold gas.
How low can we go presently? I mean, obviously, absolute zero we can't measure because there's nothing, there's no movement at all, zero Kelvin. How low can we measure at the moment?
So we can measure to within a billionth of, or we can go to within a billionth of an absolute of absolute zero. And I've been in places in Colorado where they have this ultra cold labs. They do it with atoms, particular types of atoms that they're able to cool, and they cool them using lasers that literally zap the momentum out of these particles of gas. It's incredible physics.
So we're not trying to get closer still to zero, are we? Is it that physics obsession with getting minutely closer? Because most people would say, well, one billionth of a Kelvin is pretty close to absolute zero. Why bother going any further? That's not the point of this thermometer.
Exactly. So the point here is that materials will behave differently when they're cold. And so you can tap into their quantum properties by making them very cold. So you can make new states of matter that have different properties to the states of matter that we're common with. Like, you know, this idea of there being solids, liquids and gases, that's a very junior search view of the world. There's an awful lot more out there than that. And so you can create many of these when you go very, very cold or when you go very hot. And so by making these, we can imagine things like quantum computers can be made from very cold states of molecules and atoms. So there is a lot of technology from this seemingly pointless physics.
Huh. Lara, our second story has to do with honey.
Yeah, it does. And this is a meta-analysis that's come from the universities of Oxford. We've talked about meta-analyses on the show before, and sometimes they are wonderful tools for demonstrating scientific evidence, and sometimes they are not. They've become more and more popular. Actually, I found a fact that since 1991, the number of published meta-analyses has risen more than 2,500%. And an analogy I was trying to come up with this morning, because my house is being refurbished, is that you can have the best builder in the entire world, but if every brick in your house is made out of sugar cubes, then, you know, your house is not going to survive the next storm. So you can have the best meta-analysis in the world, but if it's made up of terrible papers, it's no good. And this honey meta-analysis is sort of that second equivalent of the house made of sugar cubes. What it is showing essentially is that you are better off giving people who have a cough or a cold and who are feeling symptoms from it honey rather than antibiotics or over-the-counter medications. Now, obviously, anyone who knows anything about science whatsoever knows that obviously you don't give antibiotics for a cold. It's a virus and it doesn't work. But some doctors do because of pressure from patients to maintain the patient-doctor relationship. So, you know, obviously honey is going to be better than antibiotics because they have a negative effect and can cause antibiotic resistance. But there is evidence that shows it's better than over-the-counter, such as cough suppressants, and other things like the Benadryl that they sell in America, such as antihistamines. And we know from some of these studies that children who are given honey, say in the evenings, instead of getting cough suppressants, will have a reduced amount of coughing and will sleep better. They don't recommend anyway that you give kids cough suppressants. Just don't do it. It doesn't work for them. It gives them side effects that shouldn't happen. But, you know, it is saying that overall honey probably is going to help with some of the symptoms of coughs and colds. Honey is fantastic. The bees deposit hydrogen peroxide into the honey as they're making it, which means that it can kill a lot of different bacteria. And Manuka honey, for instance, has been shown to kill the H. pylori that causes stomach ulcers. It can also kill Staphylococcus, E. coli, all sorts of things. So honey is a great system to get rid of certain types of antibacteria. It doesn't cure cancers, as have been claimed in the media before. But honey is great. And really important to remember that children under the age of one should never, ever get honey because it can cause botulism, which can kill them. So if you're giving your child honey for a cough and a cold, do not give it to any kid under the age of one.
Right. OK, that's a good to know as a, oh, by the way.
Yeah.
You said that honey's good. It's a good antibacterial. I think people might know that it's a natural antibacterial. But is it a natural antiviral? Because, as you say, this is colds and coughs it's talking about.
It doesn't really seem to be, Jonathan. It seems to be more of an antibacterial. And even though the bees do reduce the hydrogen peroxide, which goes into the honey, it seems to be more of a soothing effect for the coughs and the colds. And it helps with symptoms rather than actually removing the virus.
Shane, our third story is about ice sheets in Greenland. And while, good God, 2020, do we not need any more bad news, but it would be remiss of us not to to report the big papers that say things about our environment that people need to be aware of. So what's going on in Greenland?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Jonathan. We can't do the ostrich thing here of just saying, you know, we can't ignore it. There are two papers here, one positive and one really not so positive. The first one, they're both about Greenland and they're both about melting ice sheets. If all of the ice on Greenland melted, you'd be talking about a rise in sea levels of 6 meters, which is incredible.
Wow.
And given the week we've had with flooding, like, you know, you wouldn't have to think very hard as to what damage that would cause in places like Ireland, where most of us live near the coast. So these things matter. So the first story is an acute one. And this is basically work from Germany using a NASA satellite, where they've been looking at the amount of ice that has melted off Greenland. And they've been doing this for a few years. And they've seen that 2019 broke all records. So the amount of ice that melted off Greenland in 2019 was incredible. We're talking 11 Olympic-sized swimming pools of ice per second.
Wow.
Just think about that. That's an incredible volume of ice. They're saying, however, that as the ice retreats, the glaciers won't be sticking their toe into the ocean. And so the rate of melting should slow. That's the positive news. I'm afraid that's the good news. The other paper is a chronic one. This is a longitudinal one. And it's from Ohio, and it's published in Nature. And they've looked at 40 years of satellite images, a different satellite, again, looking at Greenland. And they've seen this sort of pulsing of the Greenland ice sheet each year. So in the winter, it gets bigger. In the summer, it gets smaller. And up until 2000, the sort of the ebb and flow, or the growth and the melting of the ice, was more or less consistent every year. But since 2000, the chances of more ice coming onto the Greenland ice sheet over a one pulse or 1 year is 1 in 100, when it used to be even money. It used to be 50-50.
Yeah.
So this paper is far more pessimistic, and it's saying that we have reached a point of no return because of the amount of cooling that's happening. They say that one of the reasons this may be is that a lot of the surface ice is gone, it's melted, and so there's darker ice below it. And of course, black things are more readily absorb energy from the sun, and so they're more likely to melt quicker. So it is quite pessimistic. What I would say is that we shouldn't lose hope with these things. We still have to live on the planet. And so even if things are bad and we're being told that we're meeting our crossing thresholds that we can't easily go back over, we still can improve the way things are. We can still make the planet more habitable for us and our kids if we make the changes that are required. And I say again, the changes required to tackle climate change are far, far less than the changes that have been asked of us to deal with COVID.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And it's a responsibility more than something that we need to think about. Shane, thanks for that. Our final story, Lara, has to do with laughter, which is pretty thin on the ground these days.
Yeah, this is actually just a lovely little story, to be honest. So it's published in Experimental Psychology from the University of South Australia. And it's one of those stories that not only is enjoyable to hear, but it's also enjoyable if you picture them doing the study. So what they did was they took people, and in some of the groups, they got them to put a pen in between their teeth. And in the other groups, they didn't get them to put a pen in between their teeth. And what that does is, if anyone is sitting at their kitchen table right now, maybe even grab a fork and do it, or if you have a pen near you, just stick it in your mouth. It forces your mouth to do the muscular version of a smile. There may not be the emotion behind it, but you do what the muscles do. And this is And are you smiling?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Sounds good. And what they have found in this paper is that this causes the amygdala to release neurotransmitters, which increase your mood, and it increases your positivity and your perception of positivity. So they showed people faces that were somewhere on the spectrum of sad all the way up to happy. And they showed them people walking all the way on the spectrum of a sad walk all the way up to a happy walk. And they asked these people, is this a sad walk or a happy walk? Is this a sad face or a happy face? And those with the pen in between their teeth perceived them as happier. So by having the pen in your teeth and forcing yourself into a smile, you are able to see everything around you in a more positive light. So their concept is fake it till you make it. If you feel sad, try and smile, and it might slightly help you to improve your mood.
I've been talking about this in some of the training that I do, that your body, you know, people know that if you feel bad, you sort of curl up into a ball physically. And then if you stretch yourself out broad and make yourself sort of wide, you know, you can actually feel a little bit more confident before you do an interview or whatever it is. And there's been sort of backing and forth across psychologists as to whether or not the data stands up on this. But it's great to hear that this sort of feedback loop seems to exist, that if we make our body into the position that it's normally in when we're happy, we might trick ourselves into thinking we're a little bit happier. So it's nice to get a mini life hack for once.
Yeah, absolutely lovely. I love the story.
It's not gonna change the world, but it might make you feel slightly better. Dr. Laura Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much. Now, if you've ever had a casual poker night with your friends, you've probably learned that there are two types of players to watch out for. The ones who know what they're doing, and almost surprisingly, the ones who have absolutely no clue. After all, you can't bluff someone who doesn't know the rules. In any interaction with an opponent, it's important that you don't overcomplicate your strategy. As our next guest says, you need only be one step ahead. David Salley is a behavioral game theorist and author of One Step Ahead, Mastering the Art and Science of Negotiation. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's great to be with you.
I'm fascinated with the psychology of negotiation and how that works from a day-to-day level to these large merger and acquisitions conversations you imagine must be going on in the corridors of power. This book delves a lot into the science, and one of the ideas that sort of is the backbone to a lot of science on negotiation is game theory. Can you tell us what game theory is and give us an example of the sort of study that helps us apply it to negotiation?
Absolutely. Game theory is the study of how people make strategic decisions in an interactive setting. So it is the theory of how people play everything from poker to pricing wars between Uber and Lyft to any situation where the decision of one party is going to affect the outcomes or the strategy and decisions of another party. So it's used to analyze arms races, international conflicts, everything down to, again, simple card games and other things like that. The big advance, as in other areas of economics, in game theory has been the development of behavioral game theory in parallel with behavioral economics. And all that means is to bring more knowledge of and more research from the psychologists and from social psychology into the discipline of game theory. So let me give you the book and the idea of One Step Ahead is based on a very interesting behavioral game. And this game happens to be called the Beauty Contest. So you and I will play this game right now. Okay. So let me set it up. The idea of the game is, imagine we have yourself and myself and eight other people. And the decision we need to make is to choose a number between 0 and 100. And what the game master is going to do, and for the sake of argument, I'm going to be both player and game master. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take everybody's guesses. I'm going to calculate the average of those guesses, and then I'm going to trim that average by 2/3. So I will calculate the average. I will also multiply it by 2/3, and I will award a prize to the one of the 10 players whose guess is closest to 2/3 of the average.
Okay.
Okay.
So my answer, it's not as simple as what is 2/3 of 100. It's what do I think people will guess, and then what is 2/3 of the average of that?
That's right. And you can instantly see your instinct is spot on. It's not as easy as 2/3 of 100, although I will tell you, in a group of 10 people who haven't played the game before, there will be at least one person who will guess 2/3 of 100.
Okay.
And that this is where the psychology of the game begins to get really interesting. Who are you playing with? So what would your, Jonathan, what's your guess? Imagine we just have 8 people from around Newstalk. What's the...
Well, Newstalk has some smart people. Not necessarily strong in mathematics, though. So I'm guessing you might get 1/2. I'm guessing a lot of people would think, well, if it's 2/3, what's 2/3 of that? So a lot of people might guess 50. Yep. I would guess that would be the bulk of people. So maybe 7 out of 10 would guess around 50. And so I would guess 35.
Okay. Yep. So this is this beauty contest. The first paper published on it was by an economist named Rosemarie Nagel in 1995. And it has been a burgeoning area of research. And what's fascinating about it is it encapsulates this idea of being one step ahead of average opinion. The name of the game, the beauty contest, comes from John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist who in the 1930s in his famous work on the general theory of employment described what the stock market was like. He said, traders in the stock market aren't trying to figure out how much companies are worth. They are trying to figure out, as you said, Jonathan, in the beauty contest game, what's the average opinion of what the stock is worth? That's what equity markets are really like. They are markets about your opinion on average opinion and the average opinion of what the average opinion of what the average opinion is. And that is the beauty of the numerical version of this beauty contest. Okay. So the answer is typically on a first run, if we were just to take people who weren't very familiar with it, the average would come out somewhere around 36,
hey.
The actual. So that means if I take 2/3 of that, I would be, my guess would need to be something like 24.
Oh.
It's typical in the low 20s would be somewhere between 20 and 25 would be a very good guess of, you know, would be likely to win the prize in any kind of random set.
Well,
of
that's low, obviously much lower than I'd thought.
Well, so suppose we ran it that first time, it's 24. Now, what are people going to get? Suppose you say, okay, I'm offering another prize. Now, everybody's going to learn something about this game. Their guesses are going to begin to come down. So now what would we guess?
4?
You're anticipating much faster learning than many people. Typically, it would come down another... maybe 50%, maybe another 2/3 off of that, maybe like 18, 15. But eventually your 4 is going to be correct. Eventually what you see
You're so kind. That's so kind
become,
of you, David.
Where people become.
I told you people at News Talk weren't great at maths. Okay, so how does this, this sounds like a fun experiment, but this is also psychological research and behavioral research. How do you take something like that and learn something useful that can be applied in negotiation?
What this game and similar and games of that get more complicated and are done in experiments that are done in brain scanners to see which areas of people's brains light up. The fundamental thing that a reader can learn from all this is that there are different people who go into games, go into negotiations with very different levels of strategic sophistication. So there are people who, in a negotiation, as in other strategic settings, will be what I call zeros. They are deciding randomly. They are potentially irrational. They might be emotional. They might be trying to sabotage things. They might have a whole range of motivations which you cannot predict and anticipate.
You sound like you're describing Donald Trump there.
I am describing Donald Trump as I portray in the book. He is, and Trump is a really interesting person because one of the things that comes out of this strategic sophistication research, and we just did it with the beauty contest example, is people, there are some general trends. Some people are more strategically sophisticated than others, quite naturally. But there are factors that change how sophisticated somebody's likely to be. And one factor is how much experience they have in a particular setting. So I would say Trump has a lot of the characteristics of somebody who's not very sophisticated. And these are the kind of clues you're looking for when you're in a negotiation. His vocabulary is simple. His intellectual concepts are very simplistic. You say, okay, this is somebody who's not a who doesn't see complexity, who doesn't, and therefore, if you can't see complexity, you can't really dive under the surface in a setting. However, if I were, so we're talking about the Trump the politician. Trump the real estate person is much more familiar with that domain. Now, he's still not going to be the most sophisticated operator, but he's probably operating more at the level of a one, somebody who's kind of just able to maximize his or her self-interest in a given setting, knows enough about the game to just kind of blindly say, I will take as many of the gold coins off the table as I can grab, but isn't thinking through what the counterpart is likely to be up to.
You're listening to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're speaking with David Salley, author of One Step Ahead about the science of negotiation. Take me through some other social studies or behavioral studies that tell us something interesting on how we might negotiate better, because I think I'm a rubbish negotiator.
One example is that in many negotiations, you need to establish a specific stretch goal. So as in other areas of human performance, whether it's athletics or sports or training for the military or piano training, the performance benefits of having a specific goal in mind when you go into a negotiation are clear from all the research. Negotiators who have a specific goal, and by that I mean just like in a fitness kind of situation, it's as specific as you can make it. You have some doubt about whether you make it, but it's not general and squishy. Like I say, I want to lose 6 kilos, but I don't say, well, I want to do as well as I can do.
Right. In a financial negotiation, you want to say, I want to get this guy to pay 15K for this thing.
Exactly. And in fact, you might even say, I want to make this guy spend 15.25K.
Right.
There's a whole chapter on how do you use numbers. And this is something that has only been done in the scientific literature and not really pulled together for general readers about how do you communicate with numbers. And it turns out the precision of numbers is really important. And that can be in communicating to your counterpart, but also communicating to yourself. So research, and this ties to the experience, understanding how experienced your counterpart is, and therefore how sophisticated they are. So the setting of this experiment was the sale of industrial factory, and it was conducted in Germany. But what they did, it was basically a transaction in which a factory was for sale, and the subjects in the study were either younger people who had studied, students who had who were in the process of studying business in university, or they managed to get a group of people who were experienced in real estate transactions, so 20 years experience. And then they found out, in a simulation of the sale, they suggested different forms of price all around the same. So let's say one group of subjects received an opening offer of 15 million euros. Another group of subjects received one that was 15 2 million euros. And another group of subjects would have received 14,999,862 euros. And what they found was that inexperienced people were highly affected by the precision of the offer. So the more precise the offer, the less aggressive their counteroffer was to that offer. So they were affected by precision. And so if I'm dealing with somebody who is inexperienced, I might go down to the penny when I'm making my offers, if I feel comfortable doing that. However, what was interesting with the experienced people, the medium level of precision made a difference. Using a really round number caused them to make very aggressive counteroffers. So if I just said, I'm looking for 15 million euros, they would very aggressively come in at, you know, 9 million euros. But if I said 15.25, they would moderate their counteroffer. But if I said the ridiculous 14,999,000, et cetera, they would aggressively counteroffer, because they knew that that was false precision. Right. There was no way I knew that that was a proper number with enough experience. So using precision of numbers is something you can learn to do, but it all depends on its effectiveness as a tactic. And this is the point of advanced negotiation, depends on who your counterpart is and how they're imagining and how their mind works.
I once asked someone to set their own price, and I'm wondering, is that a good idea or a bad idea? It was a tenant I had, and we both knew that the rental they were renting well under, and they'd been renting for quite some time under the market rate, and I knew it needed to go up by a good bit, but I didn't really have the heart to do that. And I felt, you know what, why don't I let the tenant decide what they think is fair and something that they would automatically be able to afford because they suggested it. Would you think that was a good or a bad idea?
I think it's a perfectly valid idea. I think we need to know more about your relationship with this tenant, how fair you thought this person was. The idea of, and I think this is what you're bringing up is a great is a great topic, because it does involve this idea of fairness. And people who aren't sophisticated negotiators get all wrapped up in this topic of fairness. There is a whole chapter in the book about this topic of fairness, and kind of in line with the rest of the book, taking a clear-eyed view of what matters when it comes to fairness, what really matters. I present some data in the book about people's mental model of what a great negotiator is, and the personal characteristics of a great negotiator. Is a great negotiator? How important is toughness? How important is fairness? How important is being prepared? And people have a mental model of fairness that it should, the more fair you are, the better your performance is, the more successful a negotiator you will be. And I present data in the book that says that's just not true.
No.
Fairness has no, how fair you are. And this is like, yeah, you're laughing, and it's right. It's like, this is the cold hearted view of life. Fairness does not matter. So right. I think it's important to be really clear about what you get and what you don't get from fairness. You do not get value, tangible value in the negotiation. You do not get closer to meeting your interests or your goals from being more fair or less fair in a given negotiation. So that seems pretty gloomy. By way of aside, the single most important factor is whether you are perceived as tough or not. So the gold standard for a negotiator is to be seen as tough and fair. And our understanding of those two characteristics, the normal one is, well, that's impossible. You know, you're either tough or you're fair, right? You're either you're either an angry macho, you know, that's our sense of what toughness is. And therefore, you're going to be seen as a horrible person and you're going to be seen as unfair. And the wonderful thing is every class that I've ever had or every group of executives, there's always a handful of people who are seen as both very tough and very fair. And one of the learnings in the book is how the heck do those people, how do they do that? And the answer is that they understand what true toughness is and what true fairness is. True toughness is interior qualities. It's having a goal. It's being prepared. It's having strategic sophistication. It's knowing what the drama of negotiation is. It's knowing the power of words. It's being firm and having a in your heart, observing everything that's going on and having a no at your heart, right? Having an ability to deny the other side when you need to. The idea of fairness is that it's more performative. It's more of an outside quality. It's being willing to listen. It's treating people with respect. And it turns out that in the actual research on this in the negotiation field, that corresponds really well to some of the research that's been done primarily by law school professors on how do people in a negotiation setting really make judgments of fairness. And it turns out it's driven way less by how much of the bag of gold coins they got, namely what share of the, you know, whatever value was at available in a given negotiation, and much more by procedural process kind of things. Were they listened to? Did they feel like they were heard? Were they respected?
Yeah, empathy.
And so the great negotiator says, how do you be tough and fair? I understand that toughness is this internal quality, this that when push comes to shove, I will say no to the other side, that I'm determined, that I'm persistent. But my outside is I will treat people with respect. I will only get emotional when it's useful to me. I will not be angry unless it's instrumentally useful to me. I will be easy to deal with, and therefore people will be happy to come with me.
Hmm. And I think that is borne out in so many different fields, the idea of empathy, of being able to listen and understand things from other people's point of view while not compromising your own position too much. Finally, I wanted to ask you, is there ever a scenario when you should just walk away from a negotiation? What does the science say when it comes to just not negotiating at all?
That is maybe the single most important thing to do from preparation to being in the moment. The balancing act of a negotiator is wanting a deal and being able to walk away at the same time. And this is harder, I think for people from who are more versed in Eastern philosophy, and I push some of this on the reader. Those of us from the West are less comfortable with this, but kind of being comfortable with the contradiction of tough and fair, caring and not caring, wanting a deal and being totally happy to walk away. That's the space that great negotiators live in. The willingness to walk away, the willingness to refuse the other side is a huge source of leverage in a negotiation and a huge source of confidence. And so you need to be able to develop that sense. And I give the reader a number of clues. So let me give you one specific one that's been proven out in the laboratory with experiments. And that is just as your typical advice for a negotiator is develop your alternatives. If you don't get a deal with this other person, if you didn't get a deal with your tenant when you allowed that tenant to pick a price. So say the tenant decided to say, well, I'll pay you 10 euros this month. Well, that's not going to work so well. So what were your alternatives? Well, you'd try to find a new tenant or whatever you might do. So that is typical advice, is think about what your real alternatives are. One very creative set of psychologists said, well, I wonder if that would work if it was just imaginary alternatives. Imagine something that you really didn't have a lot of evidence for, but just like, maybe some celebrity will want to rent my flat if I turn this guy down. You know, you could be thinking that to yourself. Maybe I'll have, the most interesting writer in the world move into my flat if I turn this person down. So it turns out that even creating imaginary, fictitious alternatives makes people more confident and gives them a greater willingness to walk away, to ask for more, and that is always the balancing act. The balancing act is I need to ask for more, but that is going to risk that we might have no deal, and that's where people get very scared and very nervous about being walking away.
Well, the book is called One Step Ahead: Mastering the Art and Science of Negotiation. David Salley, author, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's been a real treat.
Tell us about your deals and whether or not you feel like you got the deal of the century. Do you have negotiation tips? Because we'd love to hear them. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. Aidan McKelvey joins me to go through some of your comments from last week. Are you good at this sort of stuff, Aidan?
No, but I did do the greatest negotiation ever by accident. So my tip would be pretend like you don't want the thing, because I was at a market somewhere in Asia, and someone kept coming over to me trying to sell me this thing. It was like a souvenir, and I genuinely was just waiting for my friend to buy something else. And I was like, let's get out of here, let's get out. I kept saying no, I wasn't paying attention to how much they were saying. And in the end, I did really need a souvenir for my parents. So when eventually came back with this ludicrously cheap price, I was like, actually, you know what? I will take that.
So don't know that you want it until you want it.
That was the best negotiation I ever did.
My two cars that I got were both advertised online as, you know, images coming soon. And I went to the dealership straight away because it was sort of the type of car I wanted to get. So I saw them before anyone else and before they'd put up the photographs or anything. And both times, I reckon I got a steal for the cars that I got. But I'm sitting there in the dealership, and I know it's a pretty good price, I think, having seen it. But I'm still like, you know, I guess, so what are you going to do for me there on the price? And the guy goes, that's the price. I'm not, there's a good price. I'm not going to mess around. And I said, look, my wife would kill me if I went into a dealership and I didn't get some money off. And the guy goes, yeah, well, it's up to you. If you want the car. And I'm like, okay, give me the car. I'm bluffing. What do you say? I mean, yeah, I really wanted the car. Maybe he could sense that, because I was like, oh, I really like this car. I'd like to buy this car. In fact, no matter what, I'm buying this car. My wife is much better. My mom is unreal. It's almost embarrassing. I kind of, if I want something to happen, I just release my mom onto the situation and I walk away, because I don't want to know what happened. All I want to know is I got the thing for the price and no one got hurt. And that, with my mom, is pretty much guaranteed. Right. The last week we talked about the Demodex, those horrible creatures that live on your face, and we had quite a violent reaction to it. One person said, would Vaseline smother them? No, it wouldn't. They don't. That would not have any real effect on them long term. And constantly applying Vaseline to your face might weird people out a little, I think. Why is your face so shiny? I'm trying to smother the creatures on my face. What about scabies? We talked about that. Yeah, that's a similar sort of infestation that people can get mostly. How do you kill them? Says another person in capitals. You don't bother, because they're just going to come back. They're just something we got to live with. But loads of people liked and then didn't like the piece. So Jen in City West said, Jonathan, I'm absolutely glued to this piece. I suffered with rosacea and almost passed out when I first heard about the cause. Now I find it fascinating. I did find a product that reduces the mites to a manageable degree. Horrific though, isn't it? It is, Jen. And then Kieran in Dublin 3 says, Jonathan, lots of people really struggle with rosacea. Some of your comments are really ignorant and crass. Honestly, expect better from you. Kieran, I mean, it is disgusting what happens, I think. I don't think that anyone can take away from the idea that these creatures eating until they explode on their face and then causing bacterial infection. I mean, that is disgusting, I find. It's not a comment on people who have rosacea, and it's absolutely not a comment on what beauty is. We could have a philosophical argument, and I've had many over the time. If you get into my household and spend dinner, you'll have these conversations. It was absolutely nothing to do with that. It was no comment on beauty or on people, but more the process and what we have to live with as humans with these things. So I'm sorry to hear that you found those comments upsetting. I don't think I crossed the line. Aidan, did anything stand out to you, or am I?
No. I think it was just because, yeah, you were grossed out by it. But I guess it's helpful to remember that the most beautiful person you ever meet will have little bugs running around their face. Indeed. It's a sort of a leveler for all.
It is indeed a leveler. It is indeed. Fee says, "Oh God, I think I'm going to vomit." Sorry about that. But we did warn you. And Anne in Kilkenny says, "Jonathan, you have to Google the Demodex. You'll never look at yourself in the same way again." Yes, totally. And that's how I felt. Another says, "Get over your squeamishness with dermatites. Every woman who's ever gone to a dermatologist with rosacea has been shown a picture of the mites magnified up to the size of the Loch Ness monster." Look. I full well know that, but it's amazing how few people knew about the Demodex. I mean, if you don't have rosacea, most people live in blissful ignorance until we broadcast it to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of listeners last week. Mairead in Cork says, "Jonathan, ew, I'll never be able to unknow that I have spiders on my face." Technically not spiders, but yeah, same family, arthropods. "I will now be obsessively looking for them in my magnified mirror every time I take off my makeup." Don't do that. "I'll be itching for the rest of the day." Yes, it did cause itching in a lot of listeners too. Another person says, "I just Googled Demodex mites and is not impressed with what they did." So look, we'll move on, but I thought it was interesting and disgusting, which is probably a nice mix for this show. We were talking about evolutionary medicine and recessive genes, and the idea that genes that can sometimes lead to fatal disease or very serious diseases may have been beneficial in other circumstances, and that's why they've survived evolution. Deirdre says, "Hi, Jonathan, can you ask if there's a similar link with CF gene? Is there something like resistance to TB linked? Interesting in an Irish context." I did ask about that, but I have a feeling producer Aidan had his scissors out and read it. Is that what happened?
Yes, I'm afraid I did, yes. I see. Two weeks in a row now.
I see, yeah. Sorry about that, Deirdre. Yes, there is theories about it, but nothing solid at the moment. Another person says, "Oh my God, how annoying is her accent? Voice rising at the end of certain words, sentences." Look, you know, it's a bit of a malaise, isn't it? It's I think it started in Dundrum, that sort of Americanization of English, where we end a sentence with a question. So it sounds like there's more to come, but there isn't, because that's the end of the sentence. But look, everybody has something, right? Let's just be kind. And listen, there's something big happening this week. Aidan, a new episode of Double Think.
Really big, yes, there is a new episode.
How is that? How is that? Was that good?
Yeah, it was great, actually. It worked out pretty well for us. It's called Does Democracy Work? And just as we were finishing it up, we were thinking we should get some politician on it if we can. And it was just as Saoirse McHugh quit the Green Party. So we thought she'd be the perfect person to talk about whether or not, from her first-hand experience, democracy works. So we had great guests, herself, Gavin Riley, a few other academics and political scientists. And you can get it where you get all your podcasts regularly and on the Go Loud app.
God has decreed that Gavin Riley can change this right
Big
now.
Damn time.
Yeah, what change are you making unilaterally?
Yeah, I feel more honest now that I'm no longer considering running for election.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. Democracy simply doesn't work.
I mean, you can imagine somebody in the Middle Ages saying, democracy has failed every time it's been tried. What are you, crazy?
You don't ask a secondary school teacher to be voted back in for the next year. And you would get a completely different cohort of people if the job at the end of the year entailed you getting voted back in for the next year.
I do think that 5 years now for a fixed sitting of a parliament is a little bit too long.
The Supreme Leader has dictated that you must be happy.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That sounds good, yeah.
It's called Doublethink. It's a good long drive of a podcast. So if you're going somewhere, it's a great accompaniment. Not to a short run. It's a good length, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's about an hour and a half. So yeah, there's a good bit of it to get your teeth into.
Look out for where you find your podcast. It's called Doublethink. That's it from us for this week. Producer Aidan McKelvey, thanks very much. Simon Keane was researching. Steve McLoon was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed on Tuesday, I think it is. In the meantime, stay curious.